Reese was simply all they knew. As he watched them, Reese wondered whether the privileged children of the Western world would be able to compete in the 21st century marketplace with kids like these. Kids who would grow up with hunger, with grit. He fleetingly thought of what amazing assets these children could be to the world, if only they could escape the radicalization efforts of those like the man he hunted. When it was Freddy's turn on the rifle, Reese did a quick check of the radio and tablet before closing his eyes. He smiled to himself, barely able to suppress his laughter, as he thought about a strikingly similar urban sniper hide more than a decade earlier. He and his platoon had been tasked with training and advising an element of Iraqi snipers. His element had made their way into an apartment, similar to the one in which he now found himself, and began the painstaking process of setting up a proper urban hide. Reese was sitting behind the spotting scope, confirming that they had a good perspective on the street below, when an overwhelming odor filled the room. He turned and was shocked to find one of the Iraqi snipers squatting a few feet behind him, defecating on the floor. The Iraqi had no regard for the fact that they were expecting to spend the next 24 to 36 hours living and working in this small space. He had to go. A CIA reports officer summed it up with a saying that gained some traction in theater. The Hodge does what the Hodge does. Maybe Iraq hadn't been as ready for Jeffersonian democracy as U.S. leaders may have hoped. One of Reese's enlisted SEALs took a digital photo of the offending turd on the floor and later displayed the print on the plywood wall of their makeshift bar back at base above a handwritten caption that read, "Real World Shit." Reese managed a few minutes of sleep, and at the top of the hour, he and Freddy traded places again. All communication was done using hand signals and facial expressions, since the neighbors would expect the apartment to be empty, and any noise from inside would arouse suspicion. The day dragged on, one rotation after another, observing the landscape of poverty like voyeuristic assassins from the First World. The room grew hot and stuffy, and by midday, they had stripped down to t-shirts and removed their low-vis body armor. At dusk, they changed to a sniper-spotter arrangement with one operator on the HK rifle and one seated just behind and to the left so that he could spot using an additional L3 LWTS thermal. Two is one, after all. Because the optics used thermal rather than traditional night vision technology, they worked in both daylight and darkness. Reese was on the rifle when an aging Mercedes microbus parked next to the target building's side entrance, and six military-age males got out and took up security positions around the structure. One of them quickly disappeared into the apartment building. The locals gave them a wide berth. Everything about their behavior indicated that they were an advanced security detail. No weapons were visible, but there was little doubt they were armed. At 7:18 p.m., the ISR feed began tracking an Opel Monterey SUV trailed by a small pickup truck as they steered their way toward the area at a high rate of speed. The two-vehicle convoy fit the profile Moe had described, and the timing was right. The SEAL sniper team observed the area, sending photos back to Langley via the Falcon radio. An hour after their arrival, Reese and Freddy noticed a perceptible shift in the advance team as they assumed a more aggressive posture. A man who appeared to be their leader reemerged from the side entrance along with another man in his 30s and a young boy. They both deduced the second man to be the boy's father. There was no sign of his mother, which was unsurprising in the Muslim world and likely also due to the nature of the transaction that was about to take place. The boy was dressed in a white, cone-shaped chalesha cap, fustanella dress-like shirt, and chamadan vest, and wore an embroidered brez sash around his waist. His parents had clad their young son in traditional Albanian dress, like he was some type of doll to make him a more hospitable sex toy for the visiting terrorist leader. The sight of it sickened both men, and Freddy was happy to be the one who would be able to put a bullet into the pedophile before he could violate this innocent child. He suppressed the urge to put a second bullet into the boy's father. Reese began whispering updates from the ISR feed as the SUV approached the target. 5 minutes out. 2 minutes out. 30 seconds out, he's passing our position. Both men watched the silver SUV and pickup pass down the gravel roadway below and to the right of their position as they steered toward the target building's side entrance. It stopped next to the curb along with the truck, the back of which was filled with armed men. The headache hit Reese with blinding speed and a pain worse than he'd yet experienced. An audible grunt and the thud of the handheld thermal hitting the floor took Freddy off the gun.
Reese, you okay?
Reese pushed as hard as he could on his temples as the pain continued to radiate and blind him.
Reese,
Freddy whispered, looking back to the scene playing out in the streets below.
Reese, shit!
Then he was gone.
I'm okay. It's all right,
Reese said, regaining his senses.
Get back in the game, buddy. How far to the SUV?
His visibly concerned friend asked. Reese picked up the thermal and consulted the range card they'd built in daylight.
210 to the SUV, he reported.
Taking a breath, he studied the laundry hanging from the building's windows.
Wind is swirling, less than 5. Hold dead on.
A half dozen men piled out of the truck's bed carrying a mix of Kalashnikov-style rifles that varied in barrel length and national origin. Some carried them slung over their backs, and all of them had their stocks folded to make the weapons more compact. They surrounded the SUV with 4 on the side near the building and 2 remaining on the street side of the vehicle. All 4 doors of the SUV opened, and Reese heard the metallic sound of strain moving the selector switch to fire. An overweight man in his 50s stepped from the back seat of the Opel and was immediately flanked by the 4 security men. Though they saw him for only a brief moment, both Reese and Freddy were confident that he was their target. Amin Nawaz knelt by the vehicle, becoming totally obscured from view by his detail. He must have waved the boy over as he was prodded forward by his father and then walked sheepishly toward the stranger. The boy disappeared into the rugby scrum of terrorists until his head popped up. Nawaz had him seated on his shoulders like a father carrying his child at a carnival.
Shit, no shot.
What's the situation? Over? The radio headphone cackled in Reese's ear.
What asshole in Langley thinks this is a good time to be on the net?
He did not respond to the ridiculous query.
Freddy exhaled deeply as he struggled with what had effectively become a hostage situation and the ultimate sniper's dilemma. The gaggle of men began to move toward the door, the SEAL shooter tracking the position of Nawaz's head as it bobbed among the men of his security detail. Between the risk of hitting the boy and the low probability of a clean hit on the target among his security men, there was nothing the snipers could do but watch. 10 seconds after placing the boy on his shoulders, Nawaz and his detail were safely inside the building.
Fuck!
Freddy whispered a bit too loudly, putting the weapon back on safe.
You didn't have a shot, buddy. You did the right thing. Okay, 2 options. Assault the building, or wait to take him out when he exits.
There's what, 12 bad guys that we know of?
Yeah, I counted 12. We wait him out.
Damn it. I can't stand the thought of what's going to happen to that kid while we wait. Fucking savages.
Freddy hissed.
I know, Freddy, me neither. But there isn't a damn thing we can do about that at the moment.
Why in the hell wouldn't they authorize a drone strike on this vehicle on its way here in the first place?
Freddy said, even though he knew the answer.
Politics with, in this case, a heavy dose of practicality. We need to protect Moe's cover to keep him a valuable asset to the U.S. government. A drone strike would look like exactly what it is, a U.S. assassination. We need this to look like an Albanian operation. We have to sit tight and take him on the way out.
Chapter 49.
Edirne, Turkey, September. Mo had signaled to Jules Landry that he needed to meet in person. The method was a simple one. A cryptic message left in the draft folder of the private messaging system on a web forum dedicated to stamp collecting. Both men had a shared login and accessed the system on a regular basis to check for unsent messages left for each other. The same method was commonly used on webmail services, but the NSA was doing a better job of monitoring accounts with no incoming and outgoing emails, so the Swiss-based Filateli server provided an extra layer of protection for those who adapted in a tech-based world. General David Petraeus had used a similar technique with his mistress until a random series of events led to its discovery by the FBI. Landry set up the meeting just outside the Greek-influenced city of Edirne near Turkey's border with Bulgaria, so that he could use one of his EU passports to escape westward if something went wrong. He walked down the gray and white mosaic sidewalks of the city and climbed into his small rental Mercedes sedan. He'd spent the night locally and had scouted the route and the meeting site. Even in his chemically altered state, he remembered his tradecraft. The road from town headed north across a narrow stone bridge. Landry breathed easier once his car was past the choke point and over the wide open swamp beyond. He turned right at the intersection and could see the ruins of the Ottoman palace ahead. Pulling the car off the road, he parked on the grass, choosing to walk the last 100 meters of open farmland. The twilight air was cool, and Landry was glad to be wearing a jacket. He had found that black leather made you all but invisible in this part of the world. His dark hair didn't hurt either. He saw little sign of activity as he approached the ruins. It was primarily an agricultural area, not prone to crowds of tourists. Unlike most of Europe, or anywhere in the United States, this historical site was open to the world with no fences, gates, or price of admission. It was simply part of the town. He saw someone leaning against the opening of the Felicity Gate, a preserved doorway of what was left of a crumbled brick palace wall. Even at this distance, he could tell it was Mo. The man smiled as he approached. Mo jerked his head toward the larger labyrinth of ruins, Landry following a few steps behind. They passed under a columned archway and into one of the few standing rooms among the remains of the once imposing structure. Mo lit a cigarette. That was the signal. As Landry stepped inside, an electric stun baton emerged from the shadows and administered 2.5 microcoulombs and 30,000 volts just below his hip. He fell forward without the ability to raise his arms and crashed face down onto the rocky ground. Mo and his paid accomplice worked quickly and had Landry flex-cuffed, with duct tape added for good measure, gagged, searched, drugged with a heavy dose of benzodiazepines, and rolled into a thick rug within minutes. They carried him into a delivery van filled with local carpets and hid him among the cargo. Mo powered off Landry's phone and zipped it into a bag designed to block all incoming and outgoing signals to prevent tracking, and pocketed his car keys to dispose of along the route. Mo handed his accomplice an envelope of cash and bid him farewell before hoisting himself into the van and turning the key to begin the long trek toward the Ibrahim Khalil border crossing. Mo was headed home. Chapter 50. Tirana, Albania, September. The waiting was brutal. Not only were Reese and Freddie under the stress of the mission and the breakdown of the original plan, but they had to effectively stand by while an innocent child endured unspeakable abuse. The men's thoughts wandered to their own children, both living and deceased. Reese knew that Freddie would be thinking of his son, Sam. He couldn't switch off being a father, no matter how hard you trained. At 9 o'clock p.m., Reese took his place behind the rifle. Dusk had turned to darkness, but the clear visual through the thermal optic turned night almost to day. The security men outside the building glowed bright white through the scope. the warm concrete standing out against the cool ground beside it. Reese turned on the illuminated mil-dot police reticle of the S&B rifle scope, the glowing red crosshairs giving him better contrast against the grayscale thermal image. Despite a population of 3,500 residents, the grounds surrounding the apartment buildings were all but deserted. No children playing, no old men smoking, no women walking to or from the nearby shopping areas. The locals knew that something was going on. They didn't need to be told. This was home. They could sense it. The only signs of life came from televisions flickering in windows and the sounds of conversations echoing down the hallway outside their door. 35 minutes into Reese's shift, the perimeter guard's behavior changed. The boss was coming out. 4 men emerged from the building's side entrance and walked to the SUV, opening the doors. Now that darkness had fallen, the men were brandishing their weapons openly. 6 at the truck, 6 on the perimeter. Reese moved the rifle selector back to fire and steadied the toe of the buttstock against the beanbag-like rear rest on the table. 2 more armed men emerged from the building and stopped halfway to the vehicle, facing outward. Reese took a deep breath, exhaled slowly, and prepared himself for a precise shot. The security detail lead emerged next, with the shorter and heavier Nawaz trailing behind him. Reese took another breath and exhaled as he began to track the white-hot moving target with his crosshairs. The leader waved his hand toward the 2 men standing in front of them. They began to walk back in his direction. Reese had mere seconds before the target would be surrounded by security men. He continued to track the target, holding the crosshairs on the front of Amin Nawaz's chest as he increased pressure on the trigger. Even suppressed, the shot was loud inside the confines of the room, especially after the man had worked in near silence for hours. The 175-grain open-tip match bullet passed across the open courtyard in a quarter of a second before slamming into Nawaz's right arm. The bullet shattered the humerus on its way into his thoracic cavity, where it center-punched a rib, sending shards of bone into his lung like shrapnel. The bullet continued its slightly downward path as it shredded its way through both lungs and exited on the offside of his body, spraying blood, bone, and even bits of his ample body hair across the graveled ground. His security man heard the sickening thwack of the bullet's impact an instant before the supersonic crack of the bullet's travel reached their ears. Nawaz lunged forward and down, crashing into his chief bodyguard. The security detail quickly became disoriented in the darkness, unsure how to react. They'd obviously spent their time intimidating civilians instead of rehearsing immediate action drills. Amin Nawaz lay face down, gasping unsuccessfully for breath as his lungs filled with blood. The 2 men closest to him finally reacted and began dragging his limp body toward the idling Opel. Reese and Freddy could hear the men yelling at one another as the rest of the team raced to surround their fallen leader.
"Hedgehog down, I say again, hedgehog down, over," Freddy reported over the radio in a calm, even tone.
"Roger that, hedgehog down," a distant command voice responded.
"Spartan, this is Renegade 2-2, over," an animated voice joined in.
"I've got you, Renegade, preparing to move."
"Roger that, I'm 10 mics out."
"Good copy."
Within 10 seconds of Freddy's radio call to Langley, the entire city of Tirana went dark. Agency hackers had breached a firewall for the Albanian power corporation, known as Kesh, a week earlier, and, with the target down, they signaled the servers to discontinue distribution of electricity to that sector of the nation's power grid. The hydroelectric plants continued to make power. The distribution points simply stopped relaying it. With Institute now thrown into absolute blackness, save for what came from the quarter moon, the terrorists' panic level increased exponentially. As Reese